Good morning, church. My name's Chet Butterworth. I'll be reading from Revelation 12. Buckle up. A great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and crying out in birth pangs, in the agony of giving birth. Then another portent appeared in heaven, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and threw them down to the earth. Then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child who is to rule, or to shepherd, all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was snatched away and taken to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, so that there she could be nourished for 1,260 days. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought back, but they were defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. The great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven proclaiming, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our comrades has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. But they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they did not cling to life, even in the face of death. Rejoice then, you heavens, and those who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and to the sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." So when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, and times, and half a time. Then from his mouth the serpent poured water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with a great flood. But the earth came to help the woman, and it opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children, those who kept the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus, the word of the Lord.
Thank you, Chet, for that outstanding reading. I hope you guys get to meet Chet. Awesome guy. So after 20 years in Snellville, Gwen and I now live in Tucker. And there are boxes all over our house. It kind of looks like, I thought this morning, it looked like a Bed Bath & Beyond, a Home Depot, and a Toys R Us exploded and just sent fragments all over the house. But I did find my sermon. I dug it out. I'd written it earlier in the week, and I thought, oh man, yesterday I thought, I hope I can find that thing. And there it was, stuffed down in somebody's seat cushion. I think Allie was probably hiding it. She probably thought that would be great. But good to be close. Last week I talked about how Revelation could be divided into 2 parts, an Act 1 and an Act 2. In Act 1, there that ended in chapter 11, last week, we saw what happens when God leaves human beings to do things their own way. leaves them up to their own choices. The world becomes a pretty dangerous and a terrifying place. And we saw that the church's role is to be a faithful witness to the good news of Jesus, in spite of however the world responds and the opposition that comes from the world. Chapter 11's parable of the church in the form of two witnesses is a brief earthly version of a longer heavenly vision that's going to unfold now over the rest of the book. The seventh trumpet sounds at the end of Act 1, and there's this announcement in heaven that the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. And the curtain goes down, and there are songs of praises echoing throughout and around God's throne. The time has come. The time has come for judging the dead, for rewarding your servants, for rewarding the prophets and the saints and all who fear your name, both small and great. And then there's this line, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. Now that's an ominous note to end on, isn't it? So chapter 12 begins, Act 2, and John sees a great portent. A portent, that just means it's a sign that points to something else, a sign filled with meaning. And he sees this portent in heaven. He's now taking a different stance. He's looking up. And it could be kind of in the sky or in heaven, and perhaps it appeared to him like a group of constellations, maybe, you know, suddenly forming and coming to life. And he sees the image of a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and on her head is a crown of 12 stars. She's pregnant, and she's crying out in the pain of childbirth. And this child, we learn, is the one who is to rule the nations, all the nations, with a rod of iron. And when John says this, or he's alluding to Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is the most quoted psalm in the New Testament. And Psalm 2 says that God's Messiah would be given the nations of the world as his inheritance, and he would rule them with a rod of iron, a symbol of strength and authority. So John sees there among the stars another sign, a red dragon in pursuit of the woman. And the dragon has 7 heads, and each head wears a crown, and he has 10 horns. And I think, you know, if the dragon's head to crowns ratio seems off here, just doesn't seem right, it's because he's pointing out symbols. These are symbols. And what it's symbolic of altogether is that the dragon, just like all the beasts in Revelation, try to mimic God. They mimic the Lamb. They want to take the authority and the honor that's due for God. They want what is rightly God's. Now, the dragon, in his pursuit of the woman, he's frantically scrambling around there in the sky, knocks a third of the stars out of the sky. He wants to devour the woman's child as soon as it's born. And just when it seems like the dragon has her cornered, the child, a son, is born. And just like that, the scripture says he's snatched away and taken to God's throne. Now notice that John calls the woman a portent or a sign. And he calls the dragon a portent, a sign. But he doesn't call the child a sign. The child is just who you think he is. The child is the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. Now John wants to do a bit more explaining about the identity of the dragon. And there in verse 9 says that this is the great dragon, that ancient serpent who is called the devil or Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. Again, John refers to the dragon as a sign and as one who's called the devil or called Satan. The character and nature of evil here in Revelation, as in our world, isn't as easy to pin down, is it? Not quite as easy as just summing it up with one name, one word. John never calls God a sign. God, though still mysterious and wrapped in mystery, is singular and personal to John. Evil, or Satan, or the devil, as evil is personified, is deceptive and slippery, morphing into one form or another that appears sometimes a lot less sinister than a dragon, less sinister than the reality. But John knows the reality of evil, and John believes in the personal nature of evil. But we also need to see that John isn't putting the devil up here on the same plane as God. There's not an evil God and a good God. And John can also go on to speak of evil being manifest in institutions or empires or in the human heart. Now, the woman that John sees is probably also representing more than what meets the eye as well. Obviously, the mother of Jesus was Mary, and so maybe he has in mind Mary here escaping to Egypt down through the desert, kind of retracing the Exodus route, trying to get away from Herod the Great, who wants to kill the child. But notice that this woman that John describes, after her child is snatched away to God, continues to be pursued by the dragon. And then she's given the wings of an eagle, and she flies into the wilderness where she's protected and nourished by God for a time, and times, two times, or half a time. All these numbers again. Again, it's one of those 3.5 numbers, which symbolizes what? A time of affliction or persecution. A broken seven. It's broken in half. Even in the wilderness, she's not free from the dragon's threats. The dragon spits out a river of water to sweep the woman away. But the earth itself comes to the aid of the woman and swallows up the flood waters. Now, just notice all the Exodus imagery in this vision. There's escape into the wilderness. Now, the Old Testament had said that God gave the children of Israel eagle's wings to escape Pharaoh and his soldiers. And then there's this flood of water, a reversal of the Red Sea image and the flood waters, engulfing Pharaoh's army. So, we can see here this Old Testament imagery. And she also has 12 stars on her crown. And you remember that Old Testament character Joseph had a vision about 12 stars circled around him, bowing down to him, the patriarchs, his brothers, the patriarchs of Israel. So when we see this image of 12 stars on her head and this all this Exodus imagery, we see she's a symbol not just of Mary, she's a symbol of Israel. She's Israel's story. But John's imagery is more complex even than that. When he identifies the dragon as that ancient serpent, our minds immediately go back to the garden. Eve, the first mother. Eve was deceived by that ancient serpent. That serpent there in the garden. And the result was her experience of pain in childbirth, labor pains, as this woman is experiencing. God promised Eve that her offspring would strike the serpent's head, and now the Lamb and the Lamb's followers have conquered Satan by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of his testimony. So the woman is Mary. The woman is Israel. The woman is the first mother, Eve. But that's not all. Verse 17 says, the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her children. You know, those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. This woman is also the mother of all believers. She is our mother, the mother of those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. She encompasses the story of Israel and the story of the church. And this is a good place to just kind of stop and recognize how complex the imagery in Revelation actually is. It defies the attempt to identify these characters with, you know, one singular person and then line them up in some kind of linear method, you know, chronological order. This is vivid, dreamlike, powerful, imaginative language. But here again is a way of picturing the church under duress, the church in the opposition of evil. When John's was picturing the church in chapter 11, he was picturing the church looking down. There are the two witnesses down there that he sees on earth. And now he takes another vantage point. He sees the church in heaven as he looks up into the sky. And so it's a cosmic image. The message is the same, though. When Christians and the church are living in difficult times, God is going to provide protection. God is going to be the one to go to for nourishment. But followers of the Lamb are still going to find themselves threatened by evil. The story here in the middle of the chapter about Michael and the angels really ramps up this cosmic imagery. This is a real Star Wars. Michael leads his troops against the dragon and the dragon's angels and just kicks them right out of heaven. But there aren't all the details about what he did, right? It's just, it happens. Ancient Jews and Christians often pictured that events on earth had their heavenly counterpart. So they could kind of think that what was happening here on earth must have a heavenly counterpart. And this is a heavenly version of the earthly war that these first followers of the Lamb are experiencing. These seven churches and their brothers and sisters across the Roman Empire who find themselves in a war between, as John wants them to understand, it's not just between the Roman authorities who are trying to, clamp down on them or perhaps persecute them. This is a war between God and evil. This is a war on a different scale than just your little community and the things that are going on in your community. And if you find yourself in that kind of war and you realize it, you know, faithful Christians here might feel that this life that's out of control, perhaps there's a bigger picture that I need to recognize. It's John saying, you know, the dragon has brought hell to earth. He's brought a war against God to earth. That's what's happening around you. Now don't give up. And don't give in. The Nigerian city of Jos, we've heard about on the news quite a bit over the past number of years, because it sits kind of on a fault line in Nigeria between the Muslim north and the more Christian south in the country. So there's been a lot of conflict between Muslims and Christians there in Jos. Not too long ago, a Nigerian church was attacked by Muslim extremists there. And they burned the church building down, and they burned down the house of the church's pastor. On the Sunday after this all happened, the people of the church came together about a mile away in a little mud-walled hut to worship. The pastor stood up and said, "First, I want to say that I am grateful that no one in this church killed anyone. during the chaos of the attacks. This pastor had gone out into the city, even during the violence, to go to each one of the homes of his church members to encourage them not to do violence, not to participate in the violence. Some of the other Muslims had thanked him later, saying, "We thank you because you have taught your people to love us, and they protected us from other people." So this pastor was very proud that his people hadn't hurt anyone during this violence. "Second," he said, "I'm grateful that they did not burn my church." Well, at this, all the people were kind of disbelieving. They can't believe what they're hearing there. They looked at him and they said, "I mean, we're here in this mud hut because they burned the church." But the pastor said, "No. Inasmuch as no church member died during this crisis, they did not burn our church. They only burned the building. We can rebuild the building, but we can't bring back to life any of our members. So I'm grateful that they did not burn the church." And then he said, "Third, I'm grateful that they burned my house as well as yours. Because if they had burned your house and not my house, how would I know how to serve you as pastor? But because they burned my house and all my possessions, I know what you're experiencing, and I will be able to be a better pastor to you. So I'm grateful they burned my house as well. We have a great pastor, a great shepherd, who came and experienced every bit of the evil that this world could dish out with us. This is the kind of insight into spiritual reality that Revelation wants us to have." Chapter 12 ends with the dragon having experienced multiple defeats. He can't catch a pregnant woman in a foot race. He couldn't gobble up a little baby. He lost this cosmic war in heaven. And he spits out a deadly flood, but the earth itself turns against him and swallows it up. You'd think he'd get the message about right now that it's time to maybe give up, at least because you're tired. But no. In our last view of him here in the chapter, the last sentence, he's standing on the sand of the seashore. Standing on the sand of the seashore. Now, for me, that sounds like a vacation, but not for the great dragon here. Because remember, the sea in Revelation is this image of evil and chaos. It's a dangerous place, and dangerous things come from the sea. The dragon, evil incarnate, is not through yet. He's standing there on the edge of the sea, and he's going to call for help. We'll start to see how that plays out next week. And then, next week, John is going to start naming names. And he's got plenty of people and places to tell us about. But just as this dragon never seems to fully die, it often seems, doesn't it, that evil is a many-headed problem. You chop off one dragon head and another one grows right back, or two, or seven. How does a Christian deal with the many faces of evil? How do Christians who endure evil's constant pursuit and maybe even persecution live faithfully like a lamb, without crumbling under the pressure or giving in or maybe just striking back, doing violence in return? The most renowned sculptor in the Soviet Union is a man named Ernst Nizvestny. Nizvestny designed Nikita Khrushchev's tombstone. He's also a faithful Christian and was eventually forced into exile by communist authorities. But before that, knowing his immense talents, the authorities, the same ones, tried to hold him there, in the Soviet Union. "We need Nizvestny," they said. "We need a communist Nizvestny." And the sculptor's final rupture with the regime took place over a work he did for a Communist Party building. He constructed a huge sculpture 50 feet high and 50 feet wide that covered the entire facade of one of the party buildings. He submitted the design to the authorities in four sections, and each section they approved. But when they put all four sections together on the facade of the building, they were furious because there was this huge cross covering the face of this building. So they confronted him, and he said, "But can't you see that it's a face?" Kind of had a double image. The cross was there, and there was also a face. They expelled him from the country, but the cross is still there. And for Christians, as we follow Christ, it seems like the cross becomes all we can see. The cross is what we see when we think about God. It's God's solution to evil. The cross is what we see when we look at the faces of other people. God's love transforming our love for others, even our enemies, even those who would be our enemies. In the cross, we remember that God, even when we would be God's enemies, became vulnerable and lived among us as Jesus. So when evil seems really, really real, we can't give in. And we can't hurt back. Kind of hard for me to stand up here and imagine it even, when about the toughest thing that we seem to ask people to do is volunteer at the funnel. We can't give in when the world asks us to strike back. And physically or in spirit, we can't do harm. We can't give up either. Maybe this is what Jesus means by picking up your own cross. And maybe picking up your own cross isn't just finally an image of destruction and devastation. It's also an image of creating something good and beautiful in the middle of chaos, dividing something into sections, dividing the world from heaven. This vision reminds us God has already won a war over evil, with the cross. And we can live with the knowledge that everyone is going to realize that one day. And maybe then everyone can live as God wants us to live, where evil has no power over us anymore. Evil is finally seen for the ineffective solution to the problems of the world that it truly is. So if you realize that this morning, if you realize that God's power is the cross, and you are willing to pick up your own cross and make something beautiful and good with your life, in your corner of the world, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.